Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the long-delayed $61 billion aid package for Ukraine passed by the House on Saturday, 311 to 112, with all Democrats for it and Republicans voting 112 to 101 against it. Joining us to discuss what Ukraine needs as Russia prepares for a June offensive with as many as 300,000 recruits mobilized, while the Ukrainians are having trouble holding the line as they run out of troops and ammunition, is Aram Shabanian, the open source information gathering manager at New Lines Institute. He recently taught in non-proliferation and terrorism studies at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies in Monterey, where his research focused on the Cold War and contemporary histories of Eastern Europe and the Middle East. Then we'll get a perspective from Ukraine on this belated boost to flagging morale as Moscow Marjorie and Trump's pro-Putin caucus for months have been doing Putin's bidding to the detriment of an outgunned and outmanned country under attack from its imperialist neighbor. Joining us is Natalia Gumenyuk, a Ukrainian journalist and CEO of the Public Interest Journalism Lab, as well as co-founder of The Reckoning Project. We will discuss her article at Foreign Affairs, Brave New Ukraine, How the World's Most Besieged Democracy is Adjusting to Permanent War. Then finally, we'll discuss the 366-58 House vote to approve a $26 billion aid package for Israel, with 37 Liberal Democrats voting no because there were no conditions on Netanyahu, and examine the ongoing war in Gaza and Israel's tenuous standoff with Iran, as both Israel and Palestine appear to be leaderless and directionless. Joining us is Stephen Simon, who served on the National Security Council staff as Senior Director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs from 2011 to 2012. He also worked on the NSC staff from 1994 to 1999 on counterterrorism and Middle East security policy. He is currently a fellow in international affairs at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. And his latest book is Grand Delusion: The Rise and Fall of American Ambition in the Middle East. We'll discuss his article at Foreign Affairs, The Middle East is Still Post-American, The Gaza War Exposes the Limits of Washington's Power, and the Risks of Overreach. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Aram Shabanian, who is the Open Source Information Gathering Manager at New Lines Institute. He recently taught in non-proliferation and terrorism studies at Middlebury Institute for International Studies in Monterey, where his research focused on the Cold War and contemporary histories of Eastern Europe and the Middle East. And he has a report at New Lines Magazine, an independent legal analysis of the Russian Federation's breaches of the Genocide Convention in Ukraine and the duty to prevent. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Shabanian.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Saturday, the House of Representatives passed the $61 billion Ukraine package. That's $48.3 billion in security assistance, $23.2 billion for replenishing weapons and equipment from the United States Department of Defense inventory, $13.8 billion for the purchase of weapons and munitions for Ukraine from U.S. manufacturers, and $11.3 billion for continued U.S. support for Ukraine through ongoing U.S. military operations in the region. And, of course, most of this money will be spent here in the United States to American defense contractors. The vote was 311 to 112. On the Republican side, 101 voted yes and 112 voted no. There were more no votes than yes votes on the Republican side. And on the Democratic side, there were 120 yes votes and zero no votes. So what do you make of what happened on Saturday?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting, especially in light of the Iranian attack on Israel earlier in the week, because I think a lot of Ukrainians, especially in the leadership, were looking at the defenses of Israel done by other countries and wondering, why not us? Why are we fighting for scraps while other American allies are seemingly flush with weapons and flush with supplies? And I don't think many people in Ukraine are going to argue that Israel shouldn't have defenses. I think what they're arguing is if it's easy for one country to get defenses that's not in NATO, why not another? And what we've seen in the last couple of months is that the Russians have steadily ground down the Ukrainian military wherever they can pin it down with massed artillery fires, massed waves of infantry, and increasingly airstrikes from far beyond the battlefield, using these, they're called glide bombs. It's essentially a traditional bomb with a wing package on it that can glide, a considerable distance, 70 to 100 miles, from the launch point, which means that the Ukrainians, who are kind of stuck with the anti-air weapons they have a lot of, the Stingers and the shoulder-fired missiles, can't do anything for them there. And so what Ukraine desperately needs now and has needed is American support in the realm of ammunition, particularly artillery ammunition, 120 millimeter, 122 millimeter and 155 millimeter artillery, but especially the 122, because that's Soviet legacy artillery ammunition, and the NATO doesn't produce a lot of it, so it's harder to find. But beyond that, it's the air defenses that the Ukrainians desperately need. As we saw last year when Ukraine was flush with air defenses, it was very difficult for the Russians to strike major cities often. That has changed. The Ukrainians have pulled their air defenses back to certain key areas, but other areas that were previously protected are now being bombed and struck. So what this aid does is it allows the Ukrainians to stand on their own 2 feet to defend themselves and to protect their country against the ongoing Russian assault. I think a lot of people on the Republican side of the aisle and a lot of people on the far left seem to think that suspending or dwindling of aid to Ukraine puts us in a safer position, that it staves off a potential conflict with Russia. And I think the reality that we learn from history and that we can look at on the ground here is that Ukraine failing on the battlefield only effectively guarantees a NATO conflict directly with Russia. And so I think that the news today is excellent. It's great news to hear that Ukraine will be bolstered with this money and this equipment. And I just hope that it comes fast enough to try to stem the tide of the upcoming Russian offensive that we're all expecting this summer.
So back to the point you made, Aram, about the Iranian attack on Israel that's expended something like 360 drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles. The coalition of US, France, and the UK, along with Jordan, shot down an awful lot of the ballistic missiles, if not all of them, using Patriot batteries, etc. And that the Ukrainians are looking at this and saying, why are you helping Israel and not us? We're defending ourselves. Israel has now killed 34,000 Palestinians. So I can understand why they're a little upset about that. But what's the situation about producing batteries? I mean, I know the Germans just gave, or they're about to give Ukraine some Patriot batteries, but what's the lag time in terms of manufacturing when now you've got this money coming in now to buy this stuff? But what's in the inventory? Because I think haven't we been depleting our inventory, and so has NATO?
And so that's where we come into the issue of supply, right? Where it's I believe there've been about 1,000 Patriot missile batteries produced since the Patriot missile battery was brought around, and about 250 of those have been exported to foreign countries other than the U.S., which is to say, the U.S. has a lot of these Patriot missile batteries in storage. Or being upgraded. I think the reason that we're seeing a large lag time in the response is one, these batteries are expensive. They are relatively technologically sophisticated. That's not to say that Ukrainians can't operate them, but there is a bit of a training time on them. There's the idea that if they get destroyed in combat, it looks bad for the West to have our, vaunted air defenses being destroyed by the Russians, which I don't necessarily agree with as an insult to the air defense. It's just what happens in war. but that's how some people interpret it. But I think the other issue is that a lot of these, especially the air defense missiles, the missiles that go in the Patriot battery themselves, the more advanced ones are quite difficult to make, and they take some time to make. And that's something that we've seen with Israel too, with their Iron Dome system, is that if you can get enough fire over the border at a certain point, they will expend most of their existing inventory of missiles. And while they still have the launchers, they don't have enough missiles to defend the launchers themselves or to defend the area, and so they pull them back. And so I think what we're seeing now is both a technical issue with lack of production and a lot of American allies asking for Patriots right now. Think of Taiwan. But there's also the lack of a political will. And this sounds cynical, but it almost feels like if Ukraine isn't in enough jeopardy, if Ukraine isn't in enough danger from assault, people in the West, namely politicians, seem to think, well, they've got this handled. They can do this. We don't need to get more involved than we already are. We've done our part. And I think that's incorrect. I think that if the US has 1,000 Patriot missile batteries, why are there not 100 of them in Ukraine right now? I mean, there's maybe a half dozen to a dozen of them total. Ukraine, if they had 3 dozen Patriot missile batteries, could protect most of their major populated areas from air assault. That alone would stifle Russia's offensive and force them to change their tactics. What they're trying to do now is what they did successfully in Syria, which is to grind down the civilian populace and make it so it's unlivable in the cities.
And since the Ukrainians have been running out of weapons and rationing what they have, and this has been several months, just recently they've lost 10% of their electric grid. And is there a Russian strategy of soaking up what air defenses they have by simply firing stuff? I mean, Russia, of course, has a greater industrial capacity than Ukraine, much greater.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of been Russia's MO across the battlefield, be it drones and aircraft, be it tanks, or be it infantry themselves. It's just that they've got more of everything than the Ukrainians. The Russian army is stronger now than it was when the war started, in numerically. And that's the point of drones, right? Is that you're not losing a pilot every time you fire one. So if they fire off 100 of these Iranian Shahed drones and 10 of them make it through, well, cool, 10 of them made it through, and sure, 90 of them got shot down, but that's not 90 pilots dead, that's 90 drones dead. And so what it does is it saps the Ukrainian air defenses that could be used for crewed aircraft, for bombers and fighters and stuff off in the distance. Those aren't being targeted as much because their munitions are what we have to, or what the Ukrainians have to target first. And so that, like you said, it soaks up all of Ukraine's air defenses and makes them quite vulnerable to mass attack.
So, General Budanov, the head of Ukraine's military intelligence directorate, a couple of days ago, he forecasted that Russia will begin a major offensive beginning in June of 2024, and that they are increasing their troop numbers enormously by 300,000, and they're also getting arms from Iran, as you mentioned, and also from North Korea. So, and apparently, in a lot of the weapons that they've shot down, the chips in them are coming from the United States and Japan and other countries. So, what's your forecast, Aram, of what's likely to happen in June? And Russians are already probing at the defenses now. And just on Saturday, the Soviet Foreign Minister Lavrov said that Russia's going to retake Kharkiv, which is close to their border, just in the north of Donbass.
Yeah, so I think, without sounding too cynical here, I've cleared my calendar for June because I'm expecting things to get intense one way or another. Either the Russians will push their offensive into Ukraine in June with a massed army and try to take cities like Kharkiv, and they won't take the cities. I don't think they have the ability to take cities like Kharkiv, Sumy, Chernihiv, and Kyiv. They can bombard them, they can assault them, but I don't think that they'll capture the cities themselves. That being said, I think that one thing a lot of people aren't paying attention to right now, and a lot of people aren't really aware of, is the inherent danger of unnecessary and unexpected escalation that nobody really wants that does lead to a conflict between NATO and the Russians. In June, we will see the apex and closure of the ongoing NATO exercise, Steadfast Defender. Steadfast Defender is the largest NATO exercise, second largest NATO exercise since the end of the Cold War. It's seeing NATO forces deployed all over Europe. And while us in the West may see it as a defensive exercise prepared to bolster alliance interoperability and whatnot, a lot of folks closer to the conflict are seeing it as preparations for war between Russia and NATO. Russians that I've interviewed have told me that, or have asked me straight up, if I think war is coming in June, and if I think it's true the rumors that NATO will attack Russia in June. And I've told them, of course, no, that's not anybody's plan, but that's the Russian streets view. The other side of that is I've been speaking with friends in the Norwegian military, and they've been telling me that they are pretty much prepared for this to go off sometime this summer, that they are prepared to get directly involved in the war. And so I think that the view that Americans have of this war is quite different from what Europeans have, especially those in Eastern and Northern Europe who see the potential here for a dangerous spiral. I mean, we saw this in 1983 with the Able Archer exercise that NATO launched. And I think that the same issues that were at play in 1983, be it the rhetoric on both sides, the number of incidents that have taken place, and the lack of communication, those are all there now. And so I think we're actually on the precipice of a nuclear crisis that a lot of people are unaware of.
But when you say that Russia plans to expand its war in June, I mean, first of all, they're not having a particularly good time in Ukraine itself. And they're using a lot of mercenaries, Nepalese, Indians, Cubans. I don't think they're doing well at all. And they're losing a lot of men and equipment, even though they are pushing Ukraine back. I think they've lost 5% of their territory since the US held up this package that just finally was passed yesterday. Do they have the resources to expand the war? What are the Norwegians expecting?
I think they do have the resources to expand the war. Maybe not in the sense of attacking a NATO ally, but I think that in the sense of doing things that are just below the threshold of an Article 5 response, the Russians really like to play in that gray area. And so we could see a lot more incidents. There was, I think, 2 days ago, two Russian GRU officers were arrested in Germany with plans to blow up German military ammunition dumps that were supplying ammunition to the Ukrainians. So that falls right below an Article 5 response, right? If it was a Russian airstrike on the depot, obviously that's an attack, but some spies, you're not really going to go to war over that. And so while the Russians will simultaneously bother, I guess is a good way to put it, NATO with these small pinprick incidents, I also think that they have the ability to massively cause problems in Ukraine. And I think that's what we really need to focus on is the fact that the Eastern Bloc members of NATO are a lot more gung-ho about taking the fight to Russia than the rest of NATO. Namely, Poland is pretty reared up and ready to go. I think that the reality on the ground for people in places like Norway or Poland is a lot closer to the way that I see it, which is that this war doesn't necessarily end when Ukraine gets Donbass back, if they got Donbass back. It doesn't end when they get Crimea back. This war is about something bigger. It's about more than just Ukraine. And I think that's what's really important to keep in mind here is that while we may see this war as limited to Ukraine, while we in the West may understand that Ukraine is an independent actor that is aligned with NATO, the Russians don't see it that way. They fundamentally fail to see it as a war with Ukraine, and they see it as a proxy fight with NATO way more than it actually is. And that's evidenced by every negotiation the Russians have had with the Ukrainians have been, okay, give us, you give us this land, you give us this and that. NATO does X, NATO does Y, NATO does Z, as if the Ukrainians have any control over what NATO does. And so I think that that mismatch in rhetoric is really telling and should be focused on.
So, just in the last minute, though, Aaron, back to the Saturday's vote to finally release the $61 billion worth of aid to Ukraine. As I mentioned, on the Republican side, 101 voted yes and 112 voted no, and including a member of the leadership, Stefanik, who's obviously angling to be Trump's vice president. It seems, though, that you almost had 112, over half of the House Republicans, doing this because of Trump, and this whole thing is being directed by Trump. So what happened to change the mind of Mike Johnson? My understanding is that because he's the speaker, he gets top-level security, top-level intelligence briefings, and that in part changed his mind. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that somebody must have put the fear of God into him. You know, somebody must have really told him what's going on in Ukraine and how desperate things are and how the only alternative to Ukraine winning the war is NATO getting involved in the war when Ukraine loses enough territory. And I think that the Russians, for their part, have been keeping an eye on the Republicans in the House and the Senate, because I think that is part of their goal, is bloody the Ukrainians and grind them down this year, wait for the Republicans to win in the fall, either Trump wins or the Republicans take the House and the Senate and stifle aid again, and then you continue to push. I think that's really the Russian goal here. And we've seen the Russians keep an eye on American politics in wars in the past. I would make an argument that the increase in bombing in places like Aleppo in November and October of 2016 was because the Russians thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the election and they had to bring a close to the war in Syria sooner than later. So there's a precedent for it too.
And of course, Johnson said that he would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. So maybe that influenced some of the Republicans. But it does seem that still to this day, Putin's best play is to get Trump elected, because Trump is clearly on Putin's side and would probably do as he promised, pull the U.S. out of NATO.
Absolutely, yes. I think that that's a valid analysis and a very real fear of mine.
Well, Aram, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Aram Shabanian, who's the Open Source Information Gathering Manager at New Lines Institute. He recently taught in Nonproliferation and Terrorism Studies at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies at Monterey, where his research focused on the Cold War and contemporary histories of Eastern Europe and the Middle East. And he has a report at New Lines Magazine, an independent legal analysis of the Russian Federation's breaches of the Genocide Convention in Ukraine and the duty to prevent. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a perspective from Ukraine on this belated boost to flagging morale, as Moscow Marjorie and Trump's pro-Putin caucus for months have been doing Putin's bidding to the detriment of an outgunned and outmanned country under attack from its imperialist neighbor. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Natalia Gumenyuk, who is a Ukrainian journalist and CEO of the Public Interest Journalism Lab, as well as co-founder of The Reckoning Project. And she has an article at Foreign Affairs, Brave New Ukraine, How the World's Most Besieged Democracy is Adjusting to Permanent War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Natalia Gumenyuk.
Thank you for reaching out to me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I imagine you and most Ukrainians are relieved that the House finally passed the $61 billion aid package. It goes to the Senate. It'll be a week or so before that it's voted on there, and then the president signs it. In the meantime, some ammunition and artillery shells can come out of U.S. storages in NATO countries and Germany. But I take it that Russia will try and take advantage of whatever delay there is in the last week. But at this moment, do you think the lines are holding in Ukraine, given that the Ukrainian army has run out of ammunition in some spots, giving the Russians an advantage?
So it's not really about the weeks because we're speaking about like the months, and the delay is not about the weeks, but really a months to extend that Ukraine was able to adjust to some point. So it's still, it's not like it cannot be too late. It's still definitely worthy. So of course, people were watching, the vote in the Congress with a. Let's say some anxiety, and we know that there should be some other decisions still made. And yes, the delay has a real like impact, not just about the front line. Probably the audience didn't hear that much about like, tragic attacks on Ukrainian cities, not because they didn't happen. They were always happening for the last year, almost on the daily basis. However, the Ukrainian air defense was capable to shut down the what was sent, the missiles which were sent on to Ukraine. And of course, the last months was more difficult because we saw that sometimes, some objects were hit mainly because it was a lack of the ammunition. On the defense line, I probably would say that no, it's pretty strong. It's rather the preparation for, like maybe a more possible assault about which, to be honest, Kremlin was ruminating since December.
Well, there is, of course, an asymmetry with the Russian population of 140 million, Ukraine 40 million. Russia is claiming to have 300,000 new recruits this year. The head of the Ukrainian army has asked for 150,000 recruits this year. There is a, well, before the war, as you wrote, there are some 10.5 billion men between the ages of 18 and 59. But the problem that the Ukrainian military have is if you bring in these young recruits and train them, the military doesn't want to replace them. The older seasoned recruits, seasoned soldiers who've been at the front line for up to 36 months, on the one hand, it's not fair to them, but on the other hand, the army needs its seasoned and trained recruits. So that's quite a dilemma, is it not?
First of all, the war, Ukrainians were always fighting with less people, and they never really had an advantage, but still they were winning. And there are numbers of wars. So, but if you really consider just the size of the country as the permanent condition, then of course we can think about this war differently. But with a proper ammunition, with a proper strategy, there is an opportunity always to defend. And that's what Ukraine was proving and trying to prove. As about the question about the new recruits, it's not just about that. So indeed, it's not really about the training. The idea that there were, people who went through the battles, through the very serious battles, even globally. Of course, they know how to fight better than anybody else. None of the best training can, substitute that. But there should be some level of fairness about the dischargement, about the rotation, and very important to understand. So it's not really about like bringing some people to the army because some people don't want and some people are tired. We're really speaking of the country which had very little money, army till 2014. Then the army grew, but still, not to extend everybody would ever think. And then you have to have 1 million people fighting. And it's more or less that, what is also important to understand, who are the people who are fighting in the Ukrainian army? The very same people that are listening to this program. They can be, working at the restaurant, they can work at the as engineers, drivers, or like just very civilians who need to, defend their country. They need to learn. So it's really what I was also writing in the article was about this dilemma on how you totally reshape your society that everybody is serving, but serving in a very dangerous environment. It's not just going to the army to be trained, possibly something happen, but also the necessity to find the balance because they are the same people who pay in taxes, but then you need to move them from paying taxes to being serving as a military. So and it's just Ukraine. Maybe a lot of people do not fully understand globally that all the money for the Ukrainian army and all the money for, like Ukrainian connected to there is paid from the Ukrainian state budget. The partners finance some other things, social, other issues, but it's the state money. So state both has to have, fund these troops. But who are funding this troop? The Ukrainian taxpayers.
Well, that means you have to have a continuing economy to generate the revenues. And it's very hard to maintain an economy when you're under attack from your neighbor. And the Russians have just knocked out 10% of the electric grid just in the last few weeks. So I've talked to a number of, I had spoke to Ilya Pomodorenko a couple of days ago, and also Anders Asland, who knows Ukraine well and was an economic advisor. He was actually quite pessimistic that this vote wouldn't take place. But they both talked about the dilemma on the part of the US from day one. On the one hand, they want to defend Ukraine, but on the other hand, they don't want to push Russia too far. So how can that be resolved? Because at the end of the day, as you point out, the Ukrainians know that they'll always have Russia and Belarus on their borders, and this war could go on forever. It will stop if Putin stops. And how do you stop Putin? And I don't understand why on the US side they're so afraid of pushing Putin too far. So how does it strike you?
I think that if you speak about pushing too far, I think Ukrainians are a bit trapped in their own successes, earlier successes of the time of the war, that people do not fully understand, including in the US, is that in fact the escalation from the Russian side is happening all the time. Somehow some of the attacks of this year, in early January, but later what had happened in March with the attack on the power grid, the most sophisticated ever a weapon which was ever used, like the Kinjal rockets. It's not one. It was believed that Patriot cannot stop them, but Patriot defense system can do that. The attacks to on Ukraine on sometimes you would have like hundreds of rockets, dozens of them being supersonic. So the escalation is there. The practice of the double strikes when the Russians are striking to the rescue workers who coming to the to rescue the people. The new strategy is there. So all the escalation is taking place, but Ukraine is still trying to deter it. So I do think that, of course, it's striking that this kind of dilemma exists. But also, Ukraine showed that, for instance, in the Black Sea, and by the way, a very interesting situation. A lot of people thought that Crimea is kind of the red line for Vladimir Putin. However, using the Ukrainian sea drone, Ukraine managed to, first of all, destroyed a number of the Russian military vessels, but also managed to push Russia closer to the Russian border from Crimea. And this helped Ukraine to defend itself because the further the Russians are close to their own borders, the most le least less precise the strikes are, they are less capable to attack Ukrainian towns. That was possible to create a passage from Odessa to deliver some of the Ukrainian agriculture products, thanks to the particular military actions, which for a while were considered like provoking, but like nobody now would speak about provoking. And so therefore we have evidence that there is a way to defend, there is a way to stop, and the Ukrainian task is actually more or less beyond, like, it's not just about getting to own borders of before the Ukrainian independence. It's really about destroying Russian capability to occupy new Ukrainian lands and have and do these strikes what they do.
So you were, Natalia, you were embedded with an elite Ukrainian paratrooper unit on the Russian border. And the soldiers all said that they just want this war to be over and they want to return home to their wives and children. And most of the soldiers are in their 30s, 40s, even 50s. So what is going to end this war? I mentioned that it's as far as I can see, it'll continue as long as Putin is in charge. And Putin, of course, wants Trump to be re-elected, so Trump will sell out Ukraine. But short of that, how is this going to end?
So indeed, it's really about destroying the Russian capabilities to launch the very same new attack of this scale on Ukraine, that they won't have, first of all, there must be some guarantees that the Ukrainian skies, would be closed and the Russians wouldn't send their missiles, rockets, but as well that they won't be capable to do these attacks. That would be that, and that would be the probably the most important for us. And yes, if you speak about the Ukrainian army, indeed, I haven't. I think there is no less militarized army you can imagine, because it's really made out of civilians who came to defend their own land. But they, as a lot of people to whom I talk. And not just that squadron with whom I was embedded by, like followed a lot of people. They just also understand everybody wants to be home, but till the risk is that their towns would be occupied, that their families are not in safety. So, for instance, like some towns, Ukrainian cities closer to the front line, closer to the Russian border, the soldiers would say, like, we better to be there, because if we would leave our positions, probably our town would be occupied, our town would be attacked.
But how do you see this ending, though?
How is it ending? The Russians are removing their troops out of the Ukrainian territory.
And how will that be achieved, given Putin's determination and just
I just given you example. I just given you the example of, how the Russians were pushed in the Black Sea to the Russian border. So the example was how they retreated from Kyiv region, the way how they retreated from the Kharkiv region. So with necessary with so I would say I the answer to this question is, if there is a question when, not about how, you say like it's possible when Ukraine has will have the needs and all necessary ammunition and other things to push them back.
So Ukraine, meanwhile, is suffering enormous casualties, and the Russians probably even more. They obviously don't announce it, and they're using a lot of mercenaries from Cuba, from Nepal, and from India. So my sense is that at some point or other, something has to break on the Russian side. And now we know that the Russian people are brainwashed with propaganda, but do you think there's any way for Putin to be defeated and removed? It would only happen on the Russian side, surely.
So the point is that it's not really about the end of the regime in Russia. The Russia, maybe Vladimir Putin can perfectly stay in the Kremlin. Of course, his departure from the Kremlin would be, of course, the a good reason to stop this war, but it's not exactly what Ukrainians are just counting on, because it may happen, might not. The idea is really about not destroying the Russian capabilities to launch further attacks and to be able all the time to, have the type of the full-scale invasion on the Ukrainian territories. Of course, some guarantees would be needed, but again, pushing them physically would be the best guarantee. And we know that, Russians can stop any given moment. The moment, the war, this war is very simple to end. You just need to have the Russian troops not being on the Ukrainian soil, and that's it. And actually, the Kremlin can always take this decision. They don't care about the public opinion. For them, it can be one day decision saying like, okay, we are done. That's it. We succeeded. They even won't need to persuade their population that they won or did something good. Even with a defeat, they can find a way to explain it to their own population.
So declare victory and go home. But just in the last couple of minutes then, Natalie, you're suggesting though, and in your article at Foreign Affairs, Brave New Ukraine, How the World's Most Besieged Democracy is Adjusting to Permanent War. Just give us a sense in closing here of what permanent war means for your country.
I'm not speaking about the permanent war. I would rather speak, would prefer to speak about the long-term and protracted war. It's indeed, finding the balance between, the normalcy, but on the duty, finding the fair way of, using the skills of the people to serve in the army, because also we understand that it's also very complicated to manage that millions of people. It's really about the running the restructuring the economy, where you understand that there are the finance, the opportunity to finance the army, to finance this new type of the state. And also, for instance, Ukrainians really do not want that much to be that much dependent of the, allies. So of course, Ukraine is trying now to invest into the production of their own weapon, which is very difficult and long-term thing. But it's also a lot about, thinking this mind that you really need to be all the time in alert. You need to be innovative, but it also won't possibly be possible without, without the support of the partners. As I want to say, needless to say, that the fact that part of the normalcy is in the Ukrainian life and the economy can pursue and people are there, it's also because, for instance, there is this air defense. And as President Zelensky said, 25 Patriots, and Ukraine now has less than 10, would actually make is are capable to do the life of the whole Ukrainian territory more normal. So, there are clear answers on how to deal with that. It shouldn't be like just either or. It's complicated, and sometimes the decisions are complicated and it takes time. There is a need to be patient. But for us, there is no other way.
Well, Natalia Gumenyuk, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Bye. Thank you. Thank you, Deline. Sorry, I'm rushing to the airport.
Okay, no
I
worries.
really can't miss this bus. Okay, bye. Bye, bye,
Bye-bye.
bye. They were calling me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Natalia Gumenyuk, who's a Ukrainian journalist and CEO of the Public Interest Journalism Lab, as well as co-founder of The Reckoning Project. And she has an article at Foreign Affairs, Brave New Ukraine, How the World's Most Besieged Democracy is Adjusting to Permanent War. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the ongoing war in Gaza and Israel's tenuous standoff with Iran, as both Israel and Palestine appear to be leaderless and directionless.
It will never return, never return. Our loved one soldier, soldier. What you gonna do when your war is older? When your mother's heart, soldier, soldier. Gonna do when your war is over, who will wait for you?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Simon, who served on the National Security Council staff as Senior Director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs from 2011 to 2012. He also worked on the NSC staff from 1994 to 1999 on counterterrorism and Middle East security policy. He is currently a fellow in international affairs at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's the co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. And his latest book is Grand Delusion, The Rise and Fall of American Ambition in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Affairs, The Middle East is Still Post-American. The Gaza War Exposes the Limits of Washington's Power and the Risks of Overreach. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Simon.
Thank you very much again.
Well, thanks for joining us, Stephen. And the House on Saturday passed a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine, and they also approved 366 to 58, a $26 billion aid package for Israel, with 37 Liberal Democrats voting no because there were no conditions on Netanyahu. But just to touch on the Ukraine aid, what do you think changed Speaker Johnson's mind? Supposedly, he had a briefing from CIA Director Burns, which really opened his eyes. He's also, his eldest son is apparently entering the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, and Speaker Johnson said that he made the decision to advance aid to Kyiv because, quote, he would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. What do you think, Stephen?
Well, I think on the whole, it was a sensible thing for him to do. I mean, the strategic implications of withholding aid to Kyiv were just so profound that they were difficult to deny. It does not surprise me that Speaker Johnson went along with this at the end of the day. I mean, he may pay a serious political price for this. But for the moment, you know, the serious right wing that was constraining him has been sidelined. So anyway, there was no denying, you know, the strategic import of this appropriation. So, you know, he really, I think, had to do it. And there was bound to be an issue one way or another that would test the arrangement that he had with the far right on the Hill. And it happened to be this one. It could have been others, but this one was cooking right now. And the Russians, you know, have been doing well, relatively speaking, you know, in their fight against the Ukrainians. And it, you know, the fight that the Ukrainians are waging against the Russians really tests not just the will of the Ukrainians, which is wavering a bit if you look at the difficulty that the Ukrainians have had recruiting troops and the speculation in Kyiv that conscription will be necessary to maintain the force size to deal with the Russian offensives that are ongoing within Ukraine. But there's a material aspect to this, as there is in the conflict between Israel and Hamas. And that material aspect is all important because it pertains to what the military calls you know, expendable things like munitions. And in between Russia and Ukraine, it's devolving to an artillery war largely. I mean, we hear a lot about drones and so forth, and that's really important, but it's an artillery war. Which means that you not only need the guns, but you need the shells. And the Ukrainians were saying that they could easily use 1 million shells in the coming months. And that sounds extraordinary, but that's the way these artillery battles are fought. So the Ukrainians would have been in deep, deep trouble if they hadn't been able to get those artillery rounds from the United States and others using this appropriation. On the Israeli Hamas front, you know, for the Israelis, the issue is tank rounds, because their expenditure of tank ammunition has been really stupendous, much greater than the rate of expenditure that the United States would experience, let's say, in combat on its own, because the U.S. and Israel have different, you know, combat doctrines on the use of armor and all that. So it does come down to these expendable, you know, items like munitions. So I think it's really important that Kyiv, you know, has gotten this from the United States. And again, it doesn't surprise me that Johnson would have gone in another direction.
So, Stephen, just turning to the ongoing war in Gaza, where Palestinian casualties have reached 34,000 dead, a lot of whom are women and children, and also Israel has a tenuous standoff with Iran following these tit-for-tat, somewhat theatrical exchanges of missiles. But in a way, what it seems to me is that the critical issue between Israel and the Palestinians is that both Israel and Palestine appear to be leaderless and directionless.
Yeah. I'm not all that sure that's true. I mean, it depends on your definitions. I think, you know, the leadership on both sides is extremely determined. Whether you're talking about Yahya Sinwar on the Hamas side or Benjamin Netanyahu on the Israeli side, they each know what they're doing in some, you know, strategic sense, but neither has a good idea of how, or a coherent idea of how to achieve their strategic goal. So, I mean, in that sense, they're rudderless. You know, each side is rudderless, but each side is led by a committed person, a committed man, you know, who's determined to go all the way. Now, there have been some contrary signals now coming from the Hamas side, where Hamas representatives have been talking about a shift from armed resistance to Israel to, you know, diplomatic and political resistance to Israel in a way that might pave a road to a union with the other factions in the Palestinian political environment that would that might actually help achieve some preliminary steps, you know, toward a two-state solution, which, of course, many regard as impossible at this point. So you're getting these contrary signals from Hamas, and it might well, you know, it might well be genuine. I mean, this and these feelers might be genuine, and they might be coming from Sinwar himself in Gaza. But you know, the signals aren't consistent enough, and they're not really sufficiently authoritative for the Israelis to contemplate, I think, you know, halting military operations. Just explaining where the Israelis are at here. I'm not being prescriptive here. Just explanatory. Mm-hmm. So I don't think things, you know, will stop in Gaza on account of these feelers.
But when I say Israel is leaderless, there seems to be no connection between the military strategy and any kind of follow-on political or diplomatic strategy. I mean, it seems to be you're back to the Israeli right-wing notion of not having a real end game except some kind of hope or wish that somehow the Palestinians would go away. And that's not going to happen, and may not even happen with Hamas, even though they've been clearly degraded. And by the way, what Hamas and Netanyahu and the Iranians have in common is they're all against a two-state solution.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that, Ian. I really do. I mean, you can see the lack of a strategy in the in this kind of a commitment that the military has made to measuring wins by casualty counts. So let me explain what I mean. In a democracy like Israel, what you would expect is for the government to stipulate the political and military objectives and let the military do their thing within the context of these well-defined, coherent military and political objectives. But since, as you point out correctly, in my view, there aren't coherent military and political objectives, the military needs some metric to show that it's winning. So they've got a kill list, and the kill list is very large. The reporting on this out of Israel has been just amazingly good on the part of Plus 972 magazine and other sources. So what the Israeli army is doing is using an algorithm to determine, you know, who to kill and when. And the list, as I just indicated, is extremely long. And that accounts for the overall casualty level, because when the people on the kill list are spotted, they're killed generally when they're at home. And that's where their families are. And in many cases, these are buildings that have other families in them. So when the bomb drops, a lot of people are killed. Now, if you'll indulge me, okay, let's go back to the Vietnam War. In the Vietnam War, casualty counts became very important. So it's how many people the U.S. Army and Marine Corps were killing in Vietnam. And that was going to determine how well the United States was doing. Now, that was not just, you know, inappropriate, you know, militarily, but it was bad in many respects. But the military had to go in that direction because it was not getting coherent and achievable objectives from the Lyndon Johnson administration. Okay, that wasn't happening. Now you're seeing this same phenomenon replay in the Gaza war. And it's and the victims, of course, are Palestinian civilians on a very large scale, as you've noted. So I agree with you that the two sides are rudderless in terms of having an actionable program that will get them their objectives. Okay, but they're not rudderless in the sense that they have this broad overall objective, I think, that you described pretty well. I mean, the Hamas wishes the Israelis would go away, and the Israelis wish that the Palestinians would go away. You're right about that, but that's a strong overall objective. But the way in which the strategies that each side is applying to this overall objective, to their overall objectives, is incoherent. And the military side, in the Israeli context, the military really doesn't know what to do except to kill people and count the number of people they're killing and then point to that and say, well, you see, we're winning.
Right. And what about the broader picture, though, Stephen? And that is, I mentioned the sort of theatrical nature of these tit-for-tat strikes. Obviously, the 360 cruise missiles, drones, and ballistic missiles that Iran fired at Israel, many were shot down by the coalition partners, the U.S., France, and Britain, and Jordan. And then the counterattack on the airfield in Isfahan was pretty limited. I think they just knocked out a radar. Obviously, that's where all the nuclear facilities are. So I suppose it's a signal in that we can do a lot more damage. But what do you make of that, which sort of characterizes as being somewhat theatrical?
I'm on your same page, Ian. I think it was performative, and it was a signaling process. So each side was signaling what it could do against the other. And on the Iranian side, when they launched those, cruise missiles and drones and all that, it was an effective signal because the Israelis know that the Iranians have a lot more than that. Okay, the Iranians could have launched a much more robust strike. They could have doubled or tripled the number of platforms and projectiles, headed Israel's way. The Israelis must also be conscious of the fact that the U.S. fleet, with its Aegis cruisers and so forth, isn't going to be in Middle Eastern waters forever. There are big problems looming with China. Whatever happens with China, it's primarily a maritime conflict. It would be a naval war. So, the United States would shot down the medium-range ballistic missiles, the most serious weapons that the Iranians fired. They're not always going to be there. So the Israelis know that too. And the Israelis also know that Israel is a very compact country geographically, and a lot of its most valuable assets are crowded into a relatively small place in a relatively small country. So it's extremely vulnerable to these kinds of barrages. If 10% of these missiles or rockets or drones get through, but 1,000 have been launched, that's 100 serious weapons launched at valuable targets within Israel. The Israelis know that. And on the other side, the Iranians understand that the Israelis not only have a wide range of missiles and rockets that they can fire at Iran that are highly accurate and extremely potent. They also know, of course, that the Israelis have nuclear weapons. So, they're going to be very cautious, and it was an effective signal on the part of Israel. I think both sides, we can we can sort of characterize this exchange as performative or theatrical or what have you, which it certainly was, but that doesn't diminish its importance or the seriousness of the signaling. And it showed, to my mind, a kind of caution and maturity on both sides that that I wasn't expecting. Let me put it that way.
So just in the last minute then, Stephen, what's going to happen next, do you think?
I honestly don't know. The next shoe to drop is whether the Israelis go into Rafah, that area in southern Gaza that they've been threatening to enter. What happens next in U.S.-Israeli relations is open to question, because the United States is poised to deny aid and training to a particular Israeli battalion, and that could go farther, even as the United States is sanctioning certain Israeli individuals for excesses, on the West Bank. I think that's going to be, problematic. And for Israel and Iran, I think things for the moment will calm down, which should also relieve Israeli fears of a Lebanese Hezbollah attack on Israel in a war in the north. So I'm kind of hoping that this exchange between Israel and Iran will sort of calm things down in that department for a while, and that on the Gaza war, Israel's approach will become more cautious because of developments within the United States, despite the fact that the administration, went for this big appropriation for Israel, for its weaponry. I think, both sides are, might be gearing up for a political fight that can complicate Israel's options.
Well, Stephen Simon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
The pleasure was all mine, Ian. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Simon, who served on the National Security Council staff as Senior Director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs. He also worked on the National Security Council staff on counterterrorism and Middle East security policy. He is currently a fellow in international affairs at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. And his latest book is Grand Delusions, The Rise and Fall of American Ambition in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Affairs, The Middle East is Still Post-American. The Gaza War Exposes the Limits of Washington's Power and the Risks of Overreach. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org. where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, and please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.